Welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations with professionals in the nonprofit world. I'm Margaret Katz-Kann, and I'm here today with my partner and teammate, David Ling Julie. Good morning, David.
Hey, Margaret. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. And we have as our guest today, Brock Warner. Brock is the author of the best-selling book, From the Ground Up, Digital Fundraising for Nonprofits. He has raised millions of dollars and developed successful campaigns, partnerships, and sector innovations, and co-founded Brockly in 2021. I'm already off to a great start here. Brock, which I'm imagining is partly why you picked the title, is also a professor of integrated marketing for nonprofits at Humber College Business School's Fundraising Management Postgraduate Program in Toronto. Welcome, Brock.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. And you're right about it. It's 50% of the reason why we chose the name Brockly. My business partner, Holly, is the latter half of that name.
I love that. It's like Benjen or...
Right. Yeah, yes. I love it. Broccoli. Yeah. That's very catchy. Very catchy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Brock, you wrote a blog that was definitely different from many, many of the blogs that we publish. And in it, you sort of challenge people to go off-road, right? To broaden where they look for inspiration in the world of fundraising. Can you tell us a little bit about your process and why that?
Well, before you go there, Brock, I want to point out to the audience that Brock is a CFRE. And so everything that he wrote about in that blog post, and hopefully we're going to talk about today, has nothing to do with CFRE. it's totally rogue.
Yeah, a little disruptive even.
Yeah. So yeah, now you can go. I just wanted people to know that you are grounded in the fundamentals of fundraising. But and for all the CFREs in the audience, we hope you'll enjoy this conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for calling that out right off the top. It's when I wrote that book, it was very important to me that if I was going to publish something and make it public and it's for the sector and for the profession of fundraising, I wanted it to cover the fundamentals. And getting my CFRE is just one way to demonstrate that I've learned the fundamentals. But throughout my career, I've always tried to hold the fundamentals in one hand and challenging status quo in the other. And so in the book, for those who have read the entire thing, I hope what they take away, if anything, is the fundamentals around digital fundraising, how to set up a program, the rationale for it, how to tell compelling stories, how to create calls to action that people want to do, how to diversify your mix of channels and tools, etc. But I certainly try to slip in little things that I get really excited about, little personal touches, like flourishes almost. And the chapter that was adapted and enriched for the blog is one of those. It's a little bit of like a Trojan horse. The book is Trojan horsing in some of these more challenging ideas, like look elsewhere. You're holding a book about fundraising, but in fact, some of the ways in which you'll make your program stand out from your peers to your donors whose inboxes are full and social media feeds are flying by, the ways you might enrich those and make those stand out won't come from a fundraising textbook. They won't come from a conference or a webinar. They might come from the least expected places. And yeah, I find that incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of, you know, when I wanted to learn how to play the piano, and I got forced to play scales first and learn they felt stupid at the time, you know, felt like I wasn't allowed to play my Beatles music right away. I had to, you know, play other things first.
Yeah. And it's, for me, it's like I'm 7 years into a 10-year quest for a black belt in jujitsu. And, we work on fundamentals all the time. You know, we just do. I mean, it's like you never, some people say once you become a black belt, that's when you really start learning. So it's the same thing for fundraising, but then you get to incorporate, like I was driving back to my home office here, and I was thinking about how, like, there's fundamentals in the art of jiu-jitsu. Also, there's fundamentals in the art of fundraising, and then there's a creativity part. There's the creative part, and that goes beyond fundamentals. In fact, we might even say that creativity is fundamental.
We could, in fact, say that. Yes.
And so, I think, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think David and I both, for the work that we do now, look into coaching and the skills of coaching and listening in order to sort of build fundraising relationships. And so that's a place, you know, I think where we both have found a lot of inspiration when we are working with fundraising teams. But that's not where you looked. So tell us, yeah, tell us,
tell us some places. Tell us one place, your most favorite place where you looked and found something surprising and that, like, most fundraisers wouldn't think about.
Architecture has given me a lot of inspiration, and I am in no way an architect or anything close to it or even aspiring to it. But I began listening to a podcast that I only started listening to because I saw it fairly high ranked in the iTunes podcast queue. And it was called 99% Invisible. It's hosted by Roman Mars, and it's about design and architecture and how so many of the things that influence our lives are largely invisible. Like the way buildings are laid out and the materials that are used and choices that are made in the design process. And so that was escapism from writing grants and following up with donors and all those things that fundraisers do every day. So that podcast was escapism, but I would find episodes that sparked ideas that I never thought possible. And I saw an applicability to my daily job and was unsuspecting. I was not expecting that. One example of that is Challenge coin. Challenge coins are something I had never heard of before. Have either of you, David or Margaret, heard of challenge coins?
No.
So challenge coins are a coin, and they're a literal token of gratitude, and it's a tradition largely in armed forces who, as individuals, not as formal ranks of bodies of government, as individuals, they will design and create coins for one another, and they'll share them amongst themselves as like a show of recognition. Like, we went through some stuff together, so like this is our coin, and they're passed with a handshake usually, and very, very subtly, and it's very much an individual to individual. And I thought, wow, that's just, I wonder if that could work in fundraising, because yeah, it's a literal token of gratitude, and we're always trying to think of ways that we can show our gratitude to donors and to do so in a very personal and meaningful way. And coins are just packed with stories. The podcast went into this, like the coins are packed, and any coin is packed with symbolism and stories. And so how I brought that over to the organization I was working with at the time is I thought, let's do this maybe for legacy donors. So donors who have included us in their will, but who are still with us. So we have the opportunity to say thanks. And what would we want that story to be? And so we packed all sorts of things like constellations that represented the pillars of our work, but also had this next layer, a story attached to them, that stars guide us in many ways in the sky, but they're in fact long, long dead. But they continue to guide us, and they continue to give us direction and ground us in our place now. And that's exactly what a legacy gift is, right? That's it's like this intergenerational guidance and support. And we also made it, this was not planned, but I've shown it to people before, but we built it. I'm holding it up for Margaret and David right now. We made a box for it out of concrete. I made them at my kitchen table, actually. And that was like an intentional choice, because concrete is a foundation. Concrete is something you can build on. And so is a legacy gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah,
you've gone through like a whole bunch of things there, and I'd love to just back up for just a minute. And, you know, my brain's going, wait, architecture, design, space, holding, container, but tell me what were the echoes of architecture and design that you brought into your fundraising work?
The idea of creating space. Architecture, as a non-architect, I think is largely about creating spaces. And we as fundraisers create spaces as well. We create spaces for conversation and generosity and recognition and curiosity about an issue and a cause and the solutions that we can attach to that need and those curiosities. And so the realization that I might in some way be an architect of a sort, of like a metaphysical space where those things happen, and that there is an opportunity to be very intentional about those spaces and how they're constructed and how they interact with one another. In the blog, I talk a little bit, and there's plenty of links about Christopher Alexander, who, along with some co-authors, wrote a massive, like 900-page book called A Pattern Language, where he identifies and describes 256 or so patterns that exist in society. And he starts at a very macro level, saying that, you know, towns are a pattern. And then within that are nested are many different patterns that can be connected in many different ways. So if one is the towns and cities, the very smallest pattern that he identified that exists in a space is things from your life. So within the towns, there's regions, there's buildings, there's rooms, there's doorways, there's walls, and then there are things from your life. And these things can all be interconnected in different ways. And what Christopher Alexander was really trying, I think throughout his entire career and his life, he just passed away fairly recently, was to infuse spaces with life and asking, does this have life in it? And I think that really challenged a lot of assumptions about how buildings are built and why buildings are built, because it's a slippery concept that means different things to different people. But he was constantly challenging people to build something that had life in it. He would hold up objects like a hatchet and say, look, I think this feels like it has life in it. Does it feel like it has life in it to you? And if your answer is no, then let's explore why you feel like it's no. And if you think the answer is yes, let's explore why you think it's yes. And you'll find your own answer, and it will have different answers for different people. But yeah, could very well be true. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Dave.
No, what I like about what you're saying is that spaces architecturally, designed spaces are spaces for life. Now, if we were to use that as a metaphor, nonprofit organizations are spaces for life. And so the question for a fundraiser or for a leader in a fundraising organization is, what life are you impacting with your space, also known as your organization? And so that's a big question we get to when Margaret and I are working with leaders. Here's the fundamental question: who are you, and what are you up to in the world? Who are you?
I agree.
Yeah, it's not like, well, I work for this organization and I raise money. No, that is some of your doing, but it's not who you are, what you're up to in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I love about what you're saying, Brock, is it's the dancing with what's in the space, like not just, you know, I'm looking at it through more of a fundraising lens, and, you know, you're sitting across the table or across Zoom or wherever you are, you know, in 2022, but, you know, with another human who's trying to have impact, you know, who's trying to use their resources. And there's so much about what we create for them in terms of the experience that they're having, but also like what brings it to life. Right? Like what makes this gift feel like something big for them, important for them?
Yeah, I suspect that for most donors, there are causes they're very, very passionate about. And there are very likely many different organizations that are providing solutions to that cause in different ways. And you can zoom in far enough, and I wouldn't discredit any one of those individual organizations. But from the donor perspective, there are many different options and opportunities. And so as an organization, you should think about how can you set yourself apart, and what's more proprietary and different to you. And so much of what your day-to-day and what will power your organization will be best practices. Everything you learn in the CFRE study materials and designations, that's going to be what you build on top of. But what's going to really set you apart, I think, will be some of the outlier, very deeply personal experiences that are shared with you. And those, you could call them insights. That feels like jargon to say, by finding those insights, but really it's conversations, and it's things you learn from people who love you the most or who can't stand you. Like, it's those outliers. If there's a bell curve that all these donor relationships are on, most are going to fit into the middle. Most are going to like you. And, you know, they probably like a few other organizations who do similar work as well. They probably support 3 to 5 organizations who do this work. Finding and talking to, and like literally talking to those people who only support you or who have ceased supporting you because of something they learned or something you did. It's those outliers, those tail ends of the bell curve, that I think are where you get the really rich proprietary insights that are going to set you apart from the others. I did a presentation about this at AFP Icon four or so years ago. It was in San Antonio. It feels like yesterday and a decade ago all at once. But it was about this idea of how might the design thinking process help you deeply understand insights of those outlier ends of the bell curve, so that you can offer something that feels truly unique and feels deeply personal to you, to those supporters, because those are the ones who are going to support you year over year and include you in the will and so on.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about that's, I'm curious, like, just, is there a conversation or an example or like a time, you know, that you either as a, you know, as a business strategy consultant for clients, or actually when you were a frontline fundraiser, you know, where you really deployed some of this inspiration into a conversation or a meeting or an arc with a donor?
Well, the challenge coin that I mentioned earlier, that was deployed, yeah. handed to donors. And I did get to hear firsthand just how memorable and meaningful that was as an interaction. So yeah, that's one that really jumps to mind. There's another organization who really spoke very passionately about the way in which their Canadian-based staff and their beneficiaries in Africa, in Central Africa, about the partnership between the two. So they spoke very from a technical standpoint, from an ethical standpoint. There were many ways that they spoke at length about how considerate they were about how that partnership was presented to make sure that they balanced the power dynamic as best they could. And how I and some partners tried to summarize that was, we used an object called an Oloid, which I can hold it up. I'm holding it up to the screen, but I'll type it for the audio listeners. An Oloid is like two interlocking spheres. And so it has these two centers of gravity. So it moves in a very funky rolling pattern, but it does move straight. It does move straight. So there's a name for it that someone, a geometry specialist or a geometry nerd will know, but it became a symbol. So that's what we tried to do, is we tried to work with them and consume as much background and understand as much as we could about that programming and the approach and the method, and then try to find a symbol that could be an entry point for donors. So rather than overwhelm donors right up front with all the program information and all the methodology and all the ethical considerations and all of the details about the approach, we start with a thing, a symbol, and let me tell you about this. And from there, we can make some very logical jumps and tell a very familiar story to get to all of that important detail about how the work is done and where it's done and why it's done and who's involved and how they're involved and so on. So that's another one that comes to mind. Yeah. Oloid, so if you're listening, it's spelled OLOID. If you wanted to Google it, there's lots of fun videos of it.
So it's sort of a symbol of integration, it sounds like.
Yeah, of like two things that have interlocked, and though separate and though different, now that they're together, they can move forward together. Even if they wobble.
Yeah. Weebles wobble.
They weebles do, in fact, wobble. In real life, I do think they fall down occasionally.
No, that's interesting. I like how, you know, you're encouraging the audience to think about some tangible objects that go beyond the usual swag, shall we say, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who needs another tote bag, right?
Or another coffee mug, right? Exactly. Seriously.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. These are symbols. Cool. These are all symbols.
Right.
Where what we try to do is we try to like find something that has life in it. We're trying to answer that unanswerable question of like, does this resonate deeply in someone else? Because if we can do that, or if we can at least strive to do that, then there's a good chance we're going to resonate deeply with them, which will bring loyalty, which will bring generosity, bring commitment.
Right.
Well, it reminds me of something that Margaret and I'll speak for myself, that I remember from our coach training, Margaret, which is we call it like a structure. And oftentimes we'll work with clients and have them choose an object and imbue, or the object represents something. This is what we're talking about here with the oloid or with the coin. And, you know, for me, I can give you, Sarah, some examples here. When I was in my coach training, I tied a bandana around my backpack. So a bandana is an object, but it represented something. What did it represent? It represented my adventurous nature, because I took that bandana on nearly every mountain climb I ever went on. So there was life in there. And it was just a reminder that I am adventurous. And then I wore my paternal grandfather's wedding ring for a very long time. And it is my wedding ring, but I, because of jujitsu these days, my knuckles are a bit swollen. So it's hard for me to get it on. But that, my grandfather was a very creative person and an artist in many ways. He also had an incredible sense of humor. So it's like a talisman. I would, you know, feel that ring and remind myself that, yes, I have creativity with inside me. So these are just structures that sometimes Margaret and I'll have a client go and get something, some object, something they're trying to embody in their life. So there's that word life again. And so it sounds like, some of your work has been to help nonprofits to create or choose objects that they can give to donors as a way of reminding them about who they are.
Right. And to imbue them with something that's bigger, right? Yeah. Some meaning that's bigger than just the object. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. And to maybe bring it down to if you were a fundraiser working for a very small shop and just buying things, objects is not in your budget this year. Put it in for next year. However, all of this applies. Everything we just described, I think, applies to also naming a monthly giving program, naming a speaker series, the visual identity you give to a legacy brochure package. There are all these other non-tactile, but very much real things that you design and you develop. So if rather than just being the food bank monthly giving program, I would challenge people to think about what might be a name that resonates a little more deeply. That is not necessarily a person, but maybe it is an object, or maybe it's a concept. And you're probably not going to find that by just looking at your peers, by looking at who is right next to you and what are they doing. So rather than look to that center of the bell curve where all your peers are, then you might want to strike out and look at what are people in the private sector doing. Let's look at architecture. Let's look at who you name it, anything but another charity. Find some inspiration, bring it back, adapt it to the context that you're working in so that it's familiar, and I think you'll start to be getting towards something that has some life in it.
Yeah, love that. Is there anything else? I'm sure there is a side that, like, what else from your book is something that we should know about? Because I've only now read this excerpt so far.
The bulk of the book, though I understand if people aren't getting the impression that this is true from this conversation, 90% of the book is the fundamentals of a digital fundraising program. I teach at Humber College. I'm a professor in the postgraduate certificate program in Humber's business school. And for several years, I've been teaching the digital fundraising program and course within that program. And the course was going to undergo a restructuring for good reason. It's now much more about integrated campaigns than it is digital fundraising. And so there was just a lot of content that I had developed for that course and refined over the years for that course, 17 3-hour lectures, that not all of it was going to make it to the next course. And so I started by thinking, well, I'll just PDF my lecture slides and I'll just share it with anyone who asks. And then I realized, well, there's no context there. Then all the little stories and the tangents I went on and the examples I would cite aren't in there. So I'll write notes to the slides. And then all of a sudden I was at 6,000 words. And I thought, I'm a third of the way to a book. So let's do it right. Let's make a book. And I worked as quickly as I could to adapt it into book format, released it in September 2020, because there were so many charities, thousands upon thousands of charities who were just getting online for the first time because of COVID going on longer than most people had predicted at that point. So by September, we were about 6 months in, and charities were facing down the year-end fundraising push and didn't have email marketing programs in place, didn't have social media strategies. They had not really invested anything at any point around digital fundraising. And so a book serves that need and scratches that itch for the fundamentals. So if I have done nothing, where do I start? I really wanted to meet that need in the fundraising marketplace. So that's what the book largely is. It goes into detail on what are the main channels and what purposes do they serve? What are their superpowers? What campaign types will you want to build into your calendar? How do you structure a calendar around the year? How do you tell stories that can move people to action? I provide story structures. This the old story circle model and tease a few more as well. So that's what the book largely is.
Yeah. Yeah. What I like about that is for those of us, for those in the audience listening and sort of in a startup or a very small nonprofit structure, small organization, I guess I'll ask you the question, like, in terms of resources, what does it take to get started with some of this digital fundraising?
Well, it's going to take time. Like that's for certain. The growth of digital fundraising, which I think for the most part fits within an annual giving program, that growth comes incrementally over time through consistency and through attention to detail and testing. You're not going to jump in big leaps and bounds. And when I'm approached by potential clients or just peers or people who reach out and they're struggling financially and they need $75,000 this quarter, digital fundraising is not going to fill that for you in the same way that direct mail is not going to fill that for you. So what it takes is early on a commitment to setting aside the time to setting up some of that basic infrastructure. Like, do you have a list of people who have given you permission to email them? And if you do, then let's get that into an email marketing platform. And there are lots of them. And some of them are very cost effective, especially if you're small. There are some that if you have under a certain number of subscribers, like under 1,000, then it could be done at no cost. And if you have an email marketing program in place, great. Now let's get a welcome series in place so that when somebody signs up for your email, they get a thank you. Thank you for signing up. And here's something else you can do. Let's get that form on the website. So these are all time consuming. They require some skills, but also if you're a curious person who's willing to learn, there's plenty of resources to help you do that. You also have whether you know it or not, you have a supportive peer network around you who will help you do that. And also these are everything I just described are steps to be taken that you may not have to take again. That's why I call them like an infrastructure piece, that you're going to set up that account once, you're going to set up your email templates once, you're going to set up that welcome series once for at least the next little while. So there's an investment of time, absolutely. And then it's follow through. You know, follow through takes time as well, and it takes commitment. And as the program grows, it's going to take buy-in for more time, buy-in for more
investment. What I love about that is it has the potential to bring, done well, has the potential to bring a large number of let's just say small donors, if we want to call them small. They're not small in size, but their donations might be small at first. And but that shows affinity for the organization. And then you can start doing what Margaret and I used to do for a living, which is go meet some of those people and have conversations with them, either online via Zoom, if they're all around the world. That's the other thing that's really amazing about digital fundraising is that you can, I mean, the cost of attracting individuals from around the world is squashed to almost nothing.
Right.
And so anyway, I like that. And for the major gift, principal gift professionals out there in the audience, you know, these are your future donors.
Right. This is your pipeline. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Those major donors, don't assume those major donors haven't signed up for your emails. Don't assume the foundation administrator hasn't signed up for your emails, or the corporate giving representatives haven't signed up for emails with their personal email. You never know who is listening. And so telling your story as if those people are listening, being consistent, you never know whether those will sneak through. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen the emails come back to us with a gift attached, or call me, I have an opportunity, I want to include you in it. And they're just responding to like the April e-newsletter that went out last month that maybe didn't even have a single ask in it, but it had three important program updates. You just never know who's listening. It's a pipeline, and it's at the top of the funnel, where at the bottom might be those major donors. They have to come from somewhere.
Yes. I love that reminder. Thank you, Brock. And we love to leave our audience with a challenge or a try this at home kind of a thing. So Brock, I'd love to invite you. What do you want to invite our listeners to do, try?
Yeah, the blog that we shared, it's called Tugging at Some Threads. And I think that I would challenge you to tug at some threads. And that thread might be a curiosity that's been lingering about a skill. Maybe it's a skill you wanted to have. Maybe it's a club you wanted to join. Maybe it's a book you wanted to read that's not related to work. So if you feel some sort of voice or urge or temptation, then I would strongly encourage you, try to chase it down as best you can and tug at that thread. Something I try to do is call them experiments. Where I'll give it a month, you know, and because that makes the stakes feel a little bit lower. So I'm going to try to learn wood carving this month. I'm going to try whittling something, and, you know, I'll give it a month. And if at the end of the month, I've given myself permission to put those tools up on Marketplace and pass them along to the next person. So give yourself permission to try something, and give yourself permission also to walk away from it as well. I think you'll learn something about yourself nonetheless in the process.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much, Brock, for joining us and for sharing this chapter from your book and giving people some inspiration. I think this this week, instead of a more traditional resource, we're going to just point you back to Brock's blog, because he has many links in there, many places where he's found some inspiration or things he's reading or listening to. And I think that would be a great resource for us this week.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brock. It's been an enjoyable and highly non-conforming conversation. And building on the great foundation that many of the fundraisers in our audience have. So thank you. This podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. Please subscribe if you haven't already. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a monthly or annual contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Please make a contribution today using the link in the show notes. Now go put it into practice.